Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, folks. It's Jim Hansen from Black Five sitting in for Mr. Gaffney doing some Secure Freedom Radio today. And we have the pleasure of talking with Andy McCarthy, a frequent contributor for National Review and the gentleman who actually convicted the blind sheikh back when we weren't taking terrorism quite as seriously and unfortunately really still aren't. And Andy, welcome to the show.
Jim, good to be with you.
Well, I wanted to get your expertise around an area where you seem to be one of the leading voices, and that is our frequent failure to notice the lawfare we're conducting against ourselves and allowing others to conduct against us. We got a terrorism suspect who we did not really spend much time interrogating and basically jumped into the what seems to be the default mode for the Obama administration, which is let's take him to court. Let's get them lawyered up and let's make sure that they get all the rights that they are somehow accorded under our system. The problem I see, and I believe you have been a leading voice in pointing out, is that severely hamstrings us as far as being able to gain intelligence, especially actionable intelligence, about what's going on. How do you feel this might have hampered us in I guess, investigating his actions, his brother's actions in Russia, and his ability to tell us what those were?
Well, Jim, when you get a situation like this, you have to make up your mind ahead of time whether you're dealing with a warfare slash national security situation or whether you're investigating a crime. If you decide you're investigating a crime, there's a whole set of protocols that apply to that. If you decide that this is a wartime situation, that the need to prove a criminal case is subordinate to the need to protect the country and therefore to gain actionable intelligence, there's a different set of protocols and a much more forgiving one in terms of gaining information that goes along with that. The problem that we have here, I think, is twofold. One is that the Obama administration's default mode, regardless of who the terrorism is committed by, assuming it's terrorism committed in the United States, I'm not now talking about their, you know, drone program against people overseas, but let's stick with here. They take the position that whenever terrorism is committed on our shores, that is a matter fit for prosecution in the criminal justice system, and therefore the regular prosecution protocols, which include Miranda warnings, obtain. And the second problem that we have with respect to that, which is a less serious problem but serious nonetheless, is that even if you could convince the Obama administration to deviate from its default mode, the problem that you have is that a military reaction or treating this as a military issue rather than a criminal justice issue requires, you know, congressional authorization through invocation by Congress of the laws of war. And what that means in a more concrete way is that Congress has to identify the enemy that we are fighting against. And, you know, the problem here is regardless of how heinous the Boston Marathon bombing was, and it's hard to think of anything on this scale that could be more heinous, do these guys who carried it out, or at least have been identified as carrying it out, fit into the category of people Congress has made the enemy for purposes of the laws of war?
Well, how are we going to find that out if we don't take the time to ask him? Well, I mean, this kid looks like a pushover. You know, he looks like the kind of guy, if you take a quick step towards him, he'd probably wet himself.
And well, I don't know about that. He was a wrestling champion in...
I don't know. I think, well, all right, regardless of his relative toughness, I think we didn't bother to find out. You know, they managed to get a judge in there way too early.
Yeah, I think here's the I think is the middle position and the one that I've been advocating, and that is that I don't think you can willy-nilly just start designating people enemy combatants. There has to be some colorable reason for suspicion that the guy fits the category of enemy that Congress has identified in the authorization of military force. In this instance, there's reason to believe that at least one of the conspirators, the older brother, got training from al-Qaeda affiliates in the northern Caucasus. There is also evidence that they copied or used at least the recipe for the kind of bomb they used that was publicized in an al-Qaeda manual, or actually their journal called Inspire. And also, finally, there's the ideological connection, which I think is too often overlooked, and that is that these guys, in their very forcible, aggressive interpretation of Islam, actually share the ideology of our enemies. I think if you take those three components together, it at least would have given the executive branch the authority to designate Dzhokhar Tsarnaev as an enemy combatant for a reasonable period of time so that the agencies could have run down the connections to al-Qaeda and our other enemies. I would point out also, Jim, that this is a problem precisely because Congress, despite the fact that some of us have been calling for this for years, continues to basically operate us under the same authorization of military force that was enacted a week after the 9/11 attacks. They have never overhauled the AUMF in order to account for the current reality of the war. So we continue to have this same problem because, you know, I think the AUMF really needs some dramatic overhaul to kind of bring it into line with who the enemy is that we're actually fighting.
Folks, we're talking with Andy McCarthy, contributor to National Review, and also the prosecutor of the Blind Sheikh from the first World Trade Center bombings. Andy, the Russian ties to me would seem to have given another good rationale for determining him to be a potential enemy combatant when the Russians asked us to investigate him, and we seem to have dropped the ball in some way. I don't want to, you know, call names to the FBI, but we did not manage to connect those dots. And now the Russians have conducted a raid over the weekend with some of the same supporters. Do you think that we may have missed the opportunity to use some interrogation tactics to find out exactly who might have trained them? Because their bombs were copied from Inspire, but not the same exact methodology. They were more advanced than what was online.
Well, look, I think there's no question, Jim, that the ball was dropped here. I mean, I I'm not looking to hammer the FBI any more than anyone else is, but you know, when you interview a guy face-to-face, as they did when they investigated in 2011 based on concerns that were raised for them by the Russian intelligence service, and then, you know, fast forward a year and you get a photograph of him as a suspect, and it turns out that you have to turn to the public for help identifying somebody that you've interviewed face-to-face because you can't do it yourself, that's a big problem. I mean, I don't know how you get around the fact that the ball was dropped here. And I think the basic problem, let's leave aside the alarming situation with the identification. The basic problem here is the FBI has imposed on itself, and I think the Justice Department has as well, basically guidelines which divorce ideology from action, so that they basically take the position that unless you are suspected of committing an actual offense of federal law, they can't investigate, even if you are animated by and adherent to an ideology that everybody knows causes the kinds of atrocities that we have seen over the years. They basically will not look at ideology. They've taken the position that to look at ideology, and I think this is an absurd position, it would somehow be a violation of the First Amendment. Therefore, despite all the evidence they had, and there was a wealth of it, that this guy, Tamerlane Tsarnaev, was a radical Muslim, and that he was beholden to the same ideology that that inspires Al-Qaeda and its affiliates to conduct terrorist attacks, they closed the file because they didn't have any evidence that he was actually doing anything as opposed to believing something.
You know, Andy, you have pointed this out so many times. We handcuff ourselves. We stop ourselves from being able to prevent these attacks and end up serving simply as the guys drawing chalk outlines around dead bodies. Folks, Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor and contributor to National Review, showing again why we need to change the way we look at radical Islam and their war against us. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, Jim.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Hello, folks. This is Jim Hansen from Black Five, back guest hosting for Frank on Secure Freedom Radio. And we're joined this segment with Matthew Brodsky, who is director of policy for the Jewish Policy Center. And I wanted to talk with you, Matt, about how well things are going in Syria and how all our policies have been brilliantly effective, just as they have been in all the other parts of the Arab Spring, summer, fall, winter debacle. And just curious, you know, what's your overall opinion of our lack of a policy affecting that?
Well, the problem is our policy to begin with was to essentially support everything that Assad said from the get-go, which was that everything was run by al-Qaeda. It was foreign terrorists who were controlling the uprising. So we parroted that information, and it wasn't in the beginning. But very predictably, since Syria was the jumping point of most foreign jihadists going into Iraq to kill coalition troops, it really was going to be obvious that jihadists were going to be coming back and that money was going to start flowing in. So we decided to support no one. So now we have zero influence, and our policy has been to really just do nothing. And the worst thing we did is that if we had no policy at all, then don't make statements. If we're not going to do anything, if a red line is crossed with chemical weapons, then don't make that a red line. But we did make that a red line, and it's incredibly dangerous for the U.S. to not have a response to a red line being crossed, because Iran is watching, North Korea is watching, and our allies such as Israel are watching, and this just loses American credibility in our foreign policy.
Well, now you mentioned a couple things that I think are relevant. Back to the start of this and our lead from behind policy, we knew that Syria was the main supplier of terrorists and infiltrators into Iraq, killing American soldiers. They're probably tied with Iran for who was doing the most damage. And somehow we managed to convince ourselves that that wasn't going to be the case in an uprising against them, that somehow these same people who had the Islamist tendencies were not going to be the same people rising up in an uprising against Assad. It's somewhat absurd.
It's an absurd position to have. And it's something that this administration has refused to learn any of the lessons. It's kind of just decided to stick its head in the sand when it came to Syria. Instead of learning lessons from Iraq, learning lessons from Afghanistan, from Egypt, from Libya, and then learning and applying them to Syria, which is a vital interest to the United States, unlike Libya, we apparently just decided, or this administration, to stick its head in the sand and say, you know, I don't know what to do, but I'll just make a few pronouncements. We'll tell Assad he has to go, but we're not really going to have any concrete plan to see that that happens. We're going to declare that chemical weapons will be a red line, as if we're saying, no, that's okay. Feel free to use fixed wing aircraft and just bomb people. That's fine. No, that's great. Just don't use chemical weapons. Why would we believe for an instant that Assad would not test the United States' red line or test our credibility if almost every red line that we've had in the Middle East has been tested and we've lacked a response?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, you're correct on that, Matthew. Folks, we're here with Matthew Brodsky, Director of Policy for the Jewish Policy Center, and we're talking about Syria and the incoherent policy we have, or almost more accurately, the lack of a policy we've had. One of the things you've discussed is we need to do something, and we lost some opportunities early on. Do you believe there were actual groups in the Free Syrian Army and others that we could have vetted and supported and potentially created a group we could get behind who was not going to run up the black flag of al-Qaeda?
I do believe that. I believe in the beginning, this didn't start as a Islamist revolution. This started as, well, I mean, not entirely secular either, but this was a response to the regime crackdown on young kids, essentially. So we could have capitalized on that to begin with. And there was perhaps a window of opportunity where we could have been vetting groups and before the situation became radicalized. But we didn't do that. That would have been the perfect opportunity in the beginning, because if you're going to have influence at all in the future, you need to have a proverbial dog, you know, in the fight. So we didn't do that. Now, it could be that it would have just turned into a sectarian ethnic cleansing situation anyways, but we have waited until most options are being diminished and all that are left are really, really bad options. You know that there's going to be reprisals after 80,000 have been killed now. I mean, at this point, if Assad were to walk away or be killed tomorrow, this doesn't guarantee an end to the ethnic cleansing and the sectarian violence. It would likely continue, and that's a result of this many people being killed.
And we have no influence. You know, we don't have,
zero,
like
no.
You said, yeah, we didn't back anybody. We didn't make any friends or frenemies or however, you know, our allies
right.
of the moment. And consequently, we kind of lost that. Now, you mentioned...
And as far as I understand, we're not even delivering humanitarian aid under our own flag. So even what we're giving, it's not like we're getting any credit for it to begin with. So
no,
we don't have worse than doing nothing.
Yeah, and that's a sad state of affairs. Now, you mentioned something that I think is vital. President Obama drew a red line in the sand and then erased it. And I would like your opinion as to whether, because I don't believe the chemical weapons use was particularly widespread or gained Assad any real tactical advantage in the fight. He was doing quite well killing his own people with conventional weapons. Do you think that potentially this was a test to see
Absolutely.
What we do by Iran and Syria and others to see what our response would be and if we had one?
Absolutely, I agree with that. This is a test, and you can see from the Obama administration we're again equivocating. This is what we're asking for is a test that is never going to be reached when it comes to are the chemical weapons for have they been used? What the Obama administration wants now is a UN investigation. This team has already been assembled since March. They've been cooling their heels in Cyprus. They're not going to be allowed into the country. If that is the bar we're setting for us to know that there is definitive proof, then it's never going to happen.
That sounds vaguely familiar. Didn't we try that someplace quite near Syria with a UN investigation that led nowhere?
Right, exactly. So, I mean, this is actually a tried and true thing, but Obama is going to use this to not do anything. So, I mean, it's a simple dynamic. Assad can test using chemical weapons, and then as long as he doesn't let UN inspectors into the country, which he never will, then he can continue to do so because the U.S. will never say that they have definitive proof. And in the meantime, while the U.S. is equivocating, Israel has a real issue and an actual red line. It has an actual red line with Iran. It has an actual red line with Syria. And that red line is the transfer of weapons to Hezbollah. And it has done. It has taken out anti-aircraft weapons earlier in the year in a bombing raid in Syria.
And they seem to have managed to figure out Syrian air defenses quite well, whether it's through computers knocking them down or just avoiding them. So their ability to hit Syria is already been proven.
Well, and yeah, it's proven. I think in Syria, the U.S. doesn't want to hit defensive positions that are manned by Russia. But in the meantime, what is Russia exactly doing for the United States anywhere on the globe?
We're friends with them. Hillary
reset
hit the
to begin
reset.
With.
No, we're, we
exactly.
got good buddies.
So since the reset hasn't worked, it's not like the U.S. has any capital that it's gained with Russia. So we seem to be just cowering, in fear and unable to make a policy, and we have to. My bottom line is this. We don't get to choose the conflicts that we get into all the time. Sometimes conflicts choose us, and we are a leader in the world. So we're going to have to do something, and we're going to have to do something at some point. And the problem is we're waiting until all the options diminish and that we have to choose between the least, bad option. It's just not a great position to be in. And by having a red line on chemical weapons, we simply have to do something, and it has to be significant. And that's unfortunate that the administration made it a red line if it did not want to do anything to begin with. Then they should have kept their mouth closed the entire time, never asked for Assad to step down, but this is the job of presidents. This is the job of the White House, the State Department, the Defense Department. They need to be on a certain page together and know what that is. After 2 years, there's really no excuse.
Unfortunately, they are on the same page, and that page says we're going to lead from behind. Folks, that's Matthew Brodsky, Director of Policy for the Jewish Policy Center, pointing out that when the world dialed 911, they got the Pentagon, and it went to voicemail. And unfortunately, at this point, that really doesn't do the people of Syria much good. We need better than that from President Barack Obama.
to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Obama is expected soon to announce that he is once again reducing America's nuclear arsenal, probably unilaterally. He insists such cuts will induce other nations to follow his lead and in due course produce, quote, a world without nuclear weapons, unquote. The latest indication that this is dangerous nonsense comes from China. It seems that the Chinese have abandoned their past putative commitment not to be the first to use nuclear weapons. This comes amid reports that they are fielding many more of them and going to ever greater lengths to conceal their arsenal. The Obama policy of denuclearizing the United States is reckless. It jeopardizes our most important deterrent to aggression from China and other adversaries and encourages allies to get their own nuclear arms. We need a course correction, not more unilateral disarmament. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, folks. We are back. It's Jim Hansen from Black Five. And with me this segment, we have Claudia Rosette from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, who has been on what I would call the UN beat. And I wish it was the UN beat down for quite a while. She was instrumental in bringing the oil for food scandals to light back in the days of Saddam Hussein. And she currently has a piece on National Review talking about an agency of the United Nations called the Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO. And Claudia, you don't seem to think that this agency is something that we really need to be breaking our own laws to support. Give us a little background on what they do and why we're not currently, the United States, paying our dues to support their activities.
Sure. UNESCO is the UN's so-called cultural agency set up in Paris just after World War II, one of the earliest agencies of the UN. And it has been, over the years, one of the most corrupt and anti-American agencies in the UN, which is quite a distinction.
Yeah, no kidding. You got to work to do that. Yeah.
Yes, you do. It got so bad that in 1984, President Reagan simply pulled out, and the U.S. did not return until 2003 under President Bush. And the UNESCO has now distinguished itself by becoming, in 2011, the first UN agency to admit the Palestinians to full membership. In other words, trying to confer on the Palestinian Authority the full regalia of statehood, which under U.S. law, any international body that does that may not be funded by the federal government. The idea there being to hold the Palestinians to their promises, their Oslo agreement, to negotiate a genuine peace directly with Israel before seeking statehood at some place like the U.N. But the Palestinians went around this whole thing, applied for membership at UNESCO, got it by an overwhelming vote in 2011 over U.S. objections. And since then, the Director General of UNESCO, Irina Bokova, who began her UN career as a Bulgarian functionary in Soviet days, in New York, stationed in New York, has been basically lobbying Washington. She's not lobbying UNESCO members to reverse their decision in order to get U.S. funding flowing again, but by voting, by triggering this U.S. law, UNESCO lost something on the order of almost $80 billion a year in U.S. funding, because, as with most of the U.N., the U.S. had been paying the biggest share of the budget, 22% of UNESCO's budget. So the Director General of UNESCO has been lobbying Washington to get this money back. She's not arguing to the members of UNESCO that they should reverse their decision and eject the Palestinians from this full membership status. She's arguing that the U.S. should change its... Basically, she's arguing that UNESCO needs the money, and the implication of what she's arguing is that the U.S. should change its laws to accommodate UNESCO.
Well, of course we should. I mean, come on. I mean, the U.S. is obviously, if it's not Israel being wrong first, it's the U.S. being wrong. And so we are depriving the world of the valuable functions UNESCO provides based on our support of an apartheid state in Israel, right? I mean, shame on us, right?
Yeah, that's the argument. And there's more to this. And that is that the Obama administration has been basically supporting UNESCO's interest in having the U.S. change its laws so America can resume, American taxpayers can resume funding UNESCO. What does that mean? It means that even though it's right now against the law in America for the U.S. government to fund UNESCO, the administration has written into its budget request for fiscal 2014 almost $78 million for UNESCO, plus, in oblique language, $156 million in arrears for the past 2 years that have not been paid, that the U.S. has not been paying. In other words, the administration now wants almost a quarter of $1 billion for UNESCO. And in order to give this, has been stated its intention to ask Congress to waive U.S. laws so that the money can flow to this organization, which overwhelmingly outvoted the U.S. to admit the Palestinians to full membership. And by the way, seats Syria on its human rights policy committee, et cetera.
Noted human rights advocates, Syria, I think is the correct way they're supposed to be referred to. folks, we're talking with Claudia Rosette from Foundation for Defense of Democracies, who is an eagle eye on the good works, and I use that in scare quotes, the United Nations does. Now, let me ask you, if somehow Congress could be persuaded to waive our own laws or to do something along those lines, Is that the only way to do it? Could Obama somehow fund this out of other money and just assume his good friend Eric Holder won't hold him to account for it?
Look, I wouldn't rule out anything, but what the administration has been trying to do is basically establish a precedent that these laws simply don't apply. And these laws are important because they were passed in the 1990s, and what they effectively do is provide disincentives for UN, arms of the UN, to give the Palestinians full membership before the Palestinians have met their promises to negotiate a real peace with Israel. Okay. And if UNESCO, if the money starts flowing again to UNESCO, there's no more penalty to any UN agency admitting the Palestinians to full membership. In other words, all the promises that went on and all the backpatting from the US and all the assurances to Israel that it will be okay, you know, these deals will be kept, are just meaningless. And the UN is, the Palestinians, what exactly is this so-called state that UNESCO admitted? It has undefined borders. It has a rump region, breakaway region in Gaza, if you want to look at it that way. ruled by a terrorist group, Hamas. It has.
They
not
do a lot of humanitarian work now. Let's not cut them short. Irony in my voice, I hope, is coming across, people. I'm not standing up for this.
Right. And the Palestinian Authority is now 4 years overdue for an election. So we don't have a fully formed, functioning, well-defined democracy here. They don't meet the
real
criteria.
We've got a kleptocracy and a terrorocracy is what we've got, and somehow the UN is calling them a state.
They're a secure peace. And meanwhile, this is really what this all pushes for, is to anoint the UN as the arbiter of what's a state. Now, the UN, of course, didn't mind admitting North Korea, so the bar is low. But for about roughly 20 years, these laws have deterred the Palestinians from just rolling through the UN and trying to acquire statehood that way, something that the unfree, dominant members of the UN, the UN is a place where one of the biggest voting blocks is the Organization of the Islamic Conference. The second largest voting bloc, the Non-Aligned Movement, is currently chaired by Iran. Yeah, that's the UN. And waiving these laws doesn't just allow UNESCO to collect $250 million at a time when in tax money, at a time when the White House is saying it's too broke to pay for White House tours for children. It also says that the U.S. is fundamentally not serious about the official policies it brings to the table at the UN or even beyond. It says that, well, officially the U.S. demands that the Palestinians keep their promises. All that is really a low priority. The administration is willing to try to actually persuade Congress to waive U.S. law to send almost $250 million to UNESCO.
What do you think the odds are that Congress will do this? I mean, there's a Republican-controlled House. They've got the money. Do you think there's any chance John Boehner has lost his mind and would actually approve this, or is this posturing?
UNESCO has been lobbying quite hard. The director general sent a full-time staffer who is a former congressional aide to Nancy Pelosi, someone named George Papadianis, who spends much of his time in Washington for more than a year now. And his job appears to be making sure that this money starts flowing again to UNESCO. And UNESCO has been putting out great clouds of propaganda, depicted with the help of Ted Turner's UN Foundation's Better World campaign, depicting UNESCO as Secretary of State John Kerry said in his testimony recently to Congress, as this vital organization. The fact is, the U.S. was not a member of UNESCO from 1984 to 2002. The U.S. certainly didn't suffer. In fact, while I wouldn't draw direct cause and effect, may we note that that was actually a very good time. That was when America won the Cold War. Freedom was on the move. Okay, and for the U.S. to simply pull out of UNESCO, which is what we should do again at this point, rather than try and bring our money back, would probably be possibly healthy for UNESCO and certainly would do plenty to help the U.S. It would say that, yes, we are serious about not only upholding our own laws, which is a good idea, but honoring our promises to our allies and foreign policy to do things like support Israel. And that's the bottom line. Might Congress do this? Oh, yes, it is possible. It could just get tacked as an amendment onto a big spending bill. That's the strategy UNESCO's friends seem to be pursuing.
Well, we'll have to keep an eye on them. Claudia, I appreciate it. And as usual, you are pointing out the flagrant abuses conducted by the UN that we ought to pay a little bit of attention to and hopefully not pay any money for. Claudia Rosette from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Coming up next, we're going to talk with Jeremy Scahill about America's dirty wars.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Obama is expected soon to announce that he is once again reducing America's nuclear arsenal, probably unilaterally. He insists such cuts will induce other nations to follow his lead and in due course produce, quote, a world without nuclear weapons, unquote. The latest indication that this is dangerous nonsense comes from China. It seems that the Chinese have abandoned their past putative commitment not to be the first to use nuclear weapons. This comes amid reports that they are fielding many more of them and going to ever greater lengths to conceal their arsenal. The Obama policy of denuclearizing the United States is reckless. It jeopardizes our most important deterrent to aggression from China and other adversaries and encourages allies to get their own nuclear arms. We need a course correction, not more unilateral disarmament. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone.
I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey folks, Jim Hansen from Black Five, and we are back with Jeremy Scahill, who is a New York Times bestselling author of the book Blackwater, and he has a new book and movie out called Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. Welcome to the show, Jeremy.
It's good to be back with you.
Yeah, hey, I just wanted to thank you. The book it's a weighty tome. Quite a serious bit of investigative journalism and reporting, and in my opinion, a tremendous look at the successes and wonders of our counterterrorism operations. So I wanted to thank you.
I thought you might see it that way.
Yeah, I thought shining a light on those kind of things and things we don't normally get to trumpet our successes. But I get the feeling that you don't probably share my high opinion of Joint Special Operations Command and some of the clandestine and covert operations that have started to, I guess, change the way we view the world, view counterterrorism, and conduct our operations against it. What are your thoughts on that?
Right. You know, when you emailed me, Jim, and you were
sort of saying, you know, great job, but my heart sort of sunk. I was like, no, that's not it. You know, like Amnesty International, they read my book and they say, we have to do something about this. And you know, Uncle Jimbo reads my book and he says, we need to do more of this.
Exactly. So, we just need to do it better, I think.
Right. No, but I mean, in all seriousness, you know, when I, and you and I have talked about Blackwater before on the show, you know, when I wrote that book, I started hearing from a lot of guys in the special ops community, former SEALs or guys that were Rangers or Delta guys. And, you know, these guys would say, I don't care for your politics at all. And, you know, viewed me as sort of a pinko commie or whatever. But they said, you know, you were right about a lot of the stuff in Blackwater. And I got to know guys that worked in that community. And so, I mean, I think a lot of conservatives or military folks will be surprised with my book because, you know, I really did try to tell the story of some of these actions and to do it with a neutral tone. And, you know, while I have very serious concerns about torture and drone strikes and unaccountable sort of hit teams running around the world, I did really try to make the portrayal of it hold up to any scrutiny, and I tried to base it all in fact and not rhetoric.
Well, you know, and Jeremy, I will stand up for you and say I think you succeeded. I really do. I think you're one of the folks. Obviously, our politics are different sides of the fence, but you're an honest broker, and I think you did a great job of taking an objective view of it. And again, you know, I think our views diverge on whether we should be doing it. My opinion is yes, yours is probably no, and I just think we need to do it more capably. Now, I wanted to talk about a couple things, specifically the idea in drone strikes and other things like that, that a lot of the damage we do to ourselves is inflicted by the simple fact that we're conducting these operations. And you interview some folks who have been either, you know, affected, had family members killed in these, or in addition, who've had night raids. You know, the raid in Gardez was an area of focus for you. You've obviously been there. Do you take at full face value the opinions and reporting of these people as to how these events went down? Because I'm kind of skeptical of their reports.
Right. And I mean, all of us should be skeptical of, you know, of the stories that are told by, you know, survivors of these operations. I mean, as well as the guys that are doing the operations themselves. You know, I mean, what we know in Pakistan is that the ISI will sometimes try to sort of take journalists on the tour of terror and show them what they want to show them. But just because you have these forces that are engaged in propaganda doesn't mean that the world is full of, you know, liars in the aftermath of every strike or raid. And in the case of Gardez, just so people remember, this was in February 2010. A JSOC team went in and raided what they thought was a Taliban compound. And they ended up shooting and killing a number of people, including a senior Afghan police commander and three women, two of whom were pregnant. And, you know, that happens all the time. And they had been fed bad intel. So they go in, they do this. And nobody would have been court-martialed. Nothing would have been said about it if they had just said, well, we have bad intel. But instead, what they did is they, you know, they dug the bullets out of the women's bodies and then they blamed it on the Taliban. And I investigated that raid myself, as did Jerome Starkey of the Times of London. And I think that those families were telling the truth. And the fact is that Admiral William McRaven himself visited that compound and said that his men had done the raid and that they were wrong in doing it. So in that particular case, I think it was absolutely true what the family members were saying. What I will say, though, about the broader issue of drone strikes and killing innocent people, I mean, I think a tremendous number of terrorists have been killed in these drone strikes. What I'm concerned about is that when we do the so-called signature strikes, where we don't even know the identities of the people that we're killing, and we don't have any actual intelligence that they're involved in terrorist or criminal activity, we're going to open ourselves up to blowback. And, you know, as an American, I'm very concerned that we're degrading our own national security rather than enhancing it, especially when we kill innocent people.
Well, folks, we're talking with Jeremy Scahill. He is the author of a new book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, and a film. How come you're not bringing the film to D.C.? I want to see it.
I am bringing the film to D.C., man. It's going to premiere in D.C. on June 7th at the E Street Theater. I mean, we haven't announced it yet, but I'm telling you because you're my uncle.
People may not
know that, but you know, there's a lot of smoke around our relationship, Jim. You know, you're from Wisconsin. You voted for Tammy Baldwin.
And Russ Feingold. And George W. Bush. Same election. Yeah, I had yard signs that confused all my neighbors.
I'm sure, man. You're a total oddball, but that's why we love you.
Well, hey, Jeremy, I mean, you mentioned and you've kind of focused on the idea that we kill innocents in these drone strikes. We also kill terrorists. And I think in some cases there is a tendency to believe that this naturally causes us to gain enemies. And I think there's no doubt that we create situations sometimes that don't always paint us in the best light. But do you think we should simply stop taking these opportunities to return terrorists to their component molecules?
Well, I think that in Pakistan, you know, it's different than in Yemen. I do think that in Pakistan, there are communities that are probably welcoming the drone strikes because they want these thugs from Tehriki Taliban, or they want the guys from the Haqqani network to be, you know, taken out. And but in many cases, when we're killing, innocent people, their family members are going to have a motivation to want to fight us. And I heard time and time again people saying that, they wanted to put on a suicide belt and blow themselves up among the Americans in retaliation for what had been done to their family.
Well, all right. Now, let me ask you another question. Given the fact that these operations have kind of developed outside of what I think the amount of oversight you might prefer, do you think that the presidential command authority, you know, the Article II constitutional commander-in-chief authority, gives any president the right to target people anywhere on the planet, make the world a battlefield?
Right. Well, I mean, this is not something that was invented by George Bush, and this wasn't something that was invented by Barack Obama. I mean, you know, because you served, that there is this doctrine called operational preparation of the battle space that historically has been used to forward deploy small numbers of troops in countries where they predict that there could be future hostilities. And after 9/11, the world did become the battlefield. You know, the authorization for the use of military force gave wide latitude to the Pentagon and the CIA to wage these wars. And under Obama, that's been, you know, expanded or continued. And so, you know, I mean, I think we are living in a world where there are people that want to bring down our airplanes or do want to poison our water supplies or do want to blow up our subways. And we have to figure out a way to address it. My concern is more tactical rather than moral in nature about this stuff. I don't want us to give an actual motivation for these nuts to want to hurt us. And I fear that that's what we're doing, particularly in Yemen. Pakistan is a little bit of a different story. And I think that the truth is often muddied there. But in Yemen in particular, I think that's one where we really have engaged in some pure stupidity with our operations. We're not engaged in old-fashioned spying anymore in Yemen. We've outsourced our intelligence collection to the Saudis and to a network of corrupt informants and a government that uses our counterterrorism aid to repress its own people. I mean, that's not smart counterterrorism. To me, we're engaged in pure stupidity in Yemen.
Well, you know, some of that, I got to go 100% in agreement with you. I think we have all too often trusted people we have no business trusting, conducted operations that essentially are score settling between different factions rather than actual counterterrorism. And that, folks, is why I would recommend you read the book, Dirty Wars. I have been plowing through it since I got it. It's a thick book full of a lot of information you may not have heard. And you don't have to agree with Jeremy as to exactly what we should be doing. But if you want to know what we have been doing, I highly recommend the book. Thanks a lot for joining us, Jeremy. And look forward to seeing your film. What'd you say, June 7th?
Yeah, I'm going to invite you to do a talk back with people. We can do a sort of, we can do a ventriloquist show where I can position you on my lap there. I'll tell you what to say.
Yeah, good luck with
that. I'm going to get you to join Code Pink, Jimbo.
Never happen. Thanks, Jeremy,
right,
and we will see you when you bring the film to D.C. Folks,
right,
that is Secure Freedom Radio for today, and look forward to talking with you again. Frank will be back shortly to make sure that the left does not take over the planet.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.